I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. French President François Hollande declared war on ISIS after a series of coordinated attacks in Paris on Friday night and bombed the Syrian city of Raqqa last night. The terrorists targeted restaurant and concert goers, and the scenes of carnage are absolutely horrifying. It's estimated that 129 are dead, many more were wounded, some being treated for life-threatening injuries. ISIS took responsibility for the attacks, calling them the first of the storm and calling Paris the capital of prostitution and obscenity. In the last 2 weeks, ISIS took responsibility for downing a Russian airliner and carrying out an attack in Beirut, Lebanon. Joining us now is Delaware Senator Chris Coons. He sits on the Foreign Relations Committee. And Senator Coons, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be on with you.
Nice to have you with us. There is a new video, ISIS saying that it was going to threaten an attack on the United States and its allies. Is the U.S. directly at war with ISIS?
We are, and we have been, I think, for more than 14 months. And one of the issues I keep raising in the Foreign Relations Committee, as does Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, is that we should have taken up and debated and passed by now the authorization of the use of military force against ISIS that the president sent up to us many months ago. We have so far failed to get a full debate on this issue in the Republican-controlled House and Senate. And I recognize and appreciate the concerns of our full committee chairman, Senator Corker of Tennessee, that we have a divided committee, we have a divided Congress, and he has publicly expressed concerns that if we have an unsuccessful debate, we don't reach consensus and we don't actually authorize this campaign, that will weaken our efforts and send the wrong message. I still think that it's our role constitutionally to declare war. And the president sent us the appropriate notifications under the War Powers Act and sent up an authorization. I think we are at war and we should be behaving as such, and the Congress should be carrying out its role. I also, frankly, think we have a responsibility to identify how we're going to pay for this war. That didn't happen in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. There was no specific funding mechanism or authorization or effort to assess the cost. That's a specific point I've raised publicly many times in the last year. And I think we owe it to the brave men and women who serve us in our armed forces and to the taxpaying public to have a clear-eyed look at the costs, the strategy, and how we move forward as a united nation in facing the real risk that ISIS poses, not just to our regional allies, but now to all of our allies and to the United States.
Are you calling for the sending of troops back into that region of the world? And where would you send them? To Syria? To Iraq?
Troops are there, Marty. We've got 3,500 U.S. troops in Iraq. The president's recently announced the deployment of 50 special forces, U.S. troops on the ground in Syria. We had a classified briefing that lasted several hours late last week on our current strategy against ISIS and both military actions and intelligence community activity. There's another briefing tomorrow over at the White House for a bipartisan group of us. And I frankly think the larger challenge we face is coming to some consensus on how many more troops and of what kind and for what duration. Like most Democrats, I oppose a significant U.S. troop deployment on the ground. I don't want to see us go back to having 10 or 20 or 50,000 U.S. troops on the ground. I think we're only going to be successful if the United States is providing intelligence and logistics, munitions and air cover, and the fighting on the ground is being done by Muslim troops, by Arab troops from the region, because, frankly, when the United States sent a significant troop presence into Iraq, our troops became the focus. I think this is what ISIS wants. I think ISIS is dreaming of an opportunity to make this a perceived war of the Christian West against the Muslim Islamic true believers of the ISIS caliphate. And I think we need to work through our partners in Iraq, the Kurds, who've been spectacular fighters, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and our regional allies, Turkey and Jordan and others, who have capable militaries and who could be pulled into a regional alliance. But we have some sharp divisions in our strategy towards Bashar al-Assad and his murderous regime that I think really has caused most of the chaos in Syria and created the opening where ISIS has emerged as this regional threat.
The Kurds did have some success last week in Iraq, taking back a city that had been taken by ISIS. And then a couple of hours later, you've got these attacks in Paris. How do you keep up? How does the U.S. and its allies keep up with the strategy that ISIS seems to be able to use so effectively?
Well, Marty, first on the ground, the town you're referring to or the city is Sinjar.
Right.
Sinjar sits literally astride the main resupply route from Raqqa in northeastern Syria to Mosul, the largest city occupied by ISIS in sort of north central Iraq. And it was the terrified Yazidi and Christian residents of Sinjar who were fleeing up Sinjar Mountain that initially precipitated American military involvement and moved President Obama to send air and troops back into Iraq to try and prevent a genocidal massacre of the Yazidi. The fact that the Kurds have retaken Sinjar is one small measure of progress on the ground. There's also an effort underway to retake Ramadi. And the prospect of some successful effort to retake Mosul and to advance on Raqqa have been publicly discussed in recent months. But we do face a real challenge on the ground. The Iraqi forces are weak and in some ways divided. We've provided a significant amount of training and logistic support. The new government of Prime Minister Abadi is trying to reverse some of the significant errors made under the previous government in Iraq, where instead of a sort of a multi-faith, multi-sectarian military force that we had poured huge amounts of money and time into training and equipping, the previous government in Iraq had really turned it into a sectarian force and had taken out many of its most competent commanders. So there's a long road in terms of getting the Iraqi security forces really able to retake Mosul and able to retake more ground in western Iraq. In Syria, it's an even more complicated situation, particularly with the Russians now sending both air and ground troops. The Russians are beginning to take casualties. And frankly, Marty, you know, it is the complexities, the difficulty, the tragedy of the Syrian civil war that is driving both the flood of hundreds of thousands, millions now, of refugees into the region and into Western Europe. And it is the challenges of being welcoming to refugees while securing borders against potential terrorist threats that's going to dominate the news and the politics of Western Europe now that there is some link suggested between one of the attackers in Paris and the Syrian refugees who are flowing into Western Europe.
And I have a couple more questions before you have to leave us. But is this a battle for territory, a battle over ideas, a combination of the two?
It's a combination of the two. Look, at the end of the day, ISIS is a Muslim jihadist cult. It is a group that is trying to restore a medieval vision of Islam that has been denounced by virtually every Muslim cleric or leader in the region. This is a fight within Islam about its true meaning and its origins and its future. So it is both a fight for ideas and a fight for territory. ISIS has reestablished a medieval caliphate, and the way that they are treating people under their occupation I think is sowing the seeds of their own destruction, because the populace of Western Iraq is not going to tolerate the kind of horrors and abuses that they impose on people in land that they occupy very long. But because of spectacular attacks, tragic and terrible attacks like the one they just carried out in Paris, they are succeeding in drawing to their cause radicalized young men from all over the world. Something like 30,000 ISIS fighters have been killed in the bombing raids that have been carried out by the United States and our many coalition partners. There have been about 7,000 bombing sorties carried out in Iraq and Syria. But every one of those ISIS fighters who's been killed has been replaced. And they, frankly, have more fighters on the ground today than they did a year and a half ago. So this is, to your question, Marty, both a war for territory and a war for ideas. And because it is a conflict within the Muslim faith over what is the true faith, there has to be a central role here for moderate, tolerant leaders in Islam to stand up and challenge the hateful and wrong ideas of ISIS and to challenge them on the ground. And I think that is the hard work that is being done by some of our regional allies who have convened leaders in the Muslim faith. But that makes it harder and more challenging and requires us to be more engaged and thoughtful in our interaction with our Muslim allies, you know, from Turkey to Jordan to Morocco to Tunisia, and with our regional allies, including the Saudis and the Qataris and the Egyptians and many others who have a role to play in how we push back on ISIS.
Do you worry about a Muslim backlash in this country? And I noticed that a number of governors and some others in this country have said we need to close our borders to Syrian refugees that want to come to this country. How do we address that?
Well, we need to be appropriately vetting refugees who we welcome into our country from whatever background and whatever country they may come. And I do think there is a balance to be struck here between ensuring that we carry our part of the burden of welcoming refugees from around the world and making sure that we are ensuring that the safety and security of the American people, which is our first obligation, is met. I've recently sat and met with leaders of the Delaware Muslim community, and they have, I think, legitimate concerns about a backlash against the Muslim community in the United States, which is an overwhelmingly skilled and sophisticated, loyal and engaged community of Americans who've come here as part of the diaspora from other parts of the world. This is a tragic and difficult part of our own history, Marty, is that, you know, when there have been wars, folks who are from the region have often been the victims of some sort of retaliation. German Americans, for example, Italian Americans in the First World War, Japanese Americans, most pointedly in the Second World War. So the idea that we have a Muslim American community that has legitimate concerns about how they are viewed and their safety, I think that is something we have to be mindful of, and we have to help engage and educate a broader American audience so they can distinguish between an extremist, radical cult that claims to be Muslim in ISIS and the law-abiding, loyal American communities that include many mosques and many folks who are eager to serve and support the United States. We have Muslim police officers.
I hate to do this to you, Senator, only because
it's important for us to recognize.
We are out of time. Senator Chris Coons, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome. Delaware Senator Chris Coons, much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the terror attacks Friday night in Paris. And joining us now is Murtaza Hussein. He's a journalist, political commentator for The Intercept, and his work focuses on human rights, foreign policy, cultural affairs. Murtaza Hussein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Also with us is Barak Mendelson. He's associate professor at Haverford College. He studies Middle East security, radical religious groups, al-Qaeda, jihadism, terrorism. He's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And he's got a book coming out next month called The Al-Qaeda Franchise. And Barak Mendelson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Barak, let me begin with you. Senator Coons talked about ISIS as a cult. Do you see it that way? A religious cult?
I think that he made progress by saying that it's a Muslim religious cult. I think that he has to speak this way. He's a politician. I have no problem with that. It's clearly a fringe group that believes that it has the right view of what Islam stands for. I think that the ultimate majority, overwhelming majority of Muslims reject that view. whether it's a sect or not, I'm not sure that's really that important.
Why not?
It's a matter of...
We need to know who we're dealing with here.
Well, that's true, but there is a lot else that we need to... I'm afraid that we're going to end up falling into those unfruitful discussions about whether it's Islamic or not, whether it's a cult, when we need to actually think about strategy. And there is a lot that we can learn about the group without coming up with those terms.
Murtaza, let me get you in on the conversation. How do you see ISIS? What and perhaps even following up on that, what do they want? And clearly they have made territorial gains, and certainly looking at what happened in Paris, just the latest of a number of terrorist attacks, they have been successful in terms of terrorizing the world. What do they want?
Well, I think that they certainly want to govern more so than previous iterations of similar terrorist groups have wanted to. Furthermore, through these attacks, reading their statement, it's very clear that there's a goal of polarizing Western societies between their Muslim minorities and the majority. And their predecessor organization used the same strategy in Iraq when it wanted to trigger a sectarian war between Sunnis and Shias. It carried out several highly deliberately provocative terrorist attacks in an effort to do that. And ultimately, it was successful. So looking at attacks like these, it's important to keep in mind that there's a strategy. And for that reason, I think that Senator Coombs' comments were quite appropriate so as not to give them that legitimacy which they're seeking.
But do you think, Murtaza, that they do want to draw the West further into war and conflict in the Middle East, and specifically in Syria?
Looking at their ideology, what they would like to do is to create more zones of chaos. They want to create... draw more combatants into the fight and polarize the world into two camps where they can claim to represent Sunni Muslims against all other adversaries against the community. So what they want to do is engender more conflict and to broaden the basis of the conflict that presently exists.
Barak, what is the appeal of shooting people, murdering people with AK-47s who are at a concert, who are having dinner outside in a cafe, in an arrondissement in Paris? What is the appeal of that?
It's really hard to tell what's the appeal of that kind of behavior, but you need to be to truly believe what you're doing in order to kill people in cold blood. You need to have gone to believe in the, you've gone through the process of the dehumanization of the other.
These are not real people to them?
They're not real people. They're definitely infidels that deserve to die. This is an even within the extreme jihadi groups, in the jihadi camp, this is a very extreme position that doesn't really allow any middle ground. And therefore, basically everybody that is not in favor of the Islamic State, it's permissible to kill him.
And hasn't even al-Qaeda criticized, maybe even rejected ISIS?
Al-Qaeda definitely rejected ISIS, though it didn't reject ISIS for killing Westerners. Al-Qaeda might have issues with the strategy and whether it's actually serving the objectives, but al-Qaeda's conflict with ISIS is more complicated. It involves, to some extent, the matter of egos. It also involves al-Qaeda trying to fight an organization that wants to take over the whole jihadi movement and is really threatening al-Qaeda and its existence.
Murtaza, let me get back to you. How do you see, and I'm actually looking off my TV here, Obama is speaking in Turkey, and he talks about pursuing a strategy. He seemed to be also saying, based on the crawl that I was reading, that he does not favor boots on the ground. What do you think there's something else the United States could and should do to deal with ISIS?
I think that they need to continue to support more thoroughly than they have been those groups. Forces on the ground which are fighting ISIS, the Kurdish forces, the Iraqi army, the Syrian rebel factions, which are overwhelmingly at odds with ISIS. There are many boots on the ground right now. They're not Western boots right at the moment, but there are things the U.S. can do to support them if they do want to ultimately terminate this so-called this regime that ISIS has created in these territories. This attack, if reading their own statements to see why, you know, what their rationale was beyond what I mentioned before, they're, as they see it, retaliating for attacks against their on their territory, airstrikes. So the U.S. and its allies should either, in my opinion, fight the war to a terminal conclusion and be frank about the costs and the necessities of doing that, or not engage with them. This current middle ground which they're in is leading to terrorism, but not quickly resulting in dissolution of the group.
But are you saying, and I want to get to Barak in on the conversation, but are you saying when you talk about the costs, Murtaza, which is that there would be, if we really were to engage in a full-out war against ISIS, there would be civilian casualties?
There are civilian casualties happening right now in their territories from these airstrikes, but certainly there would be American casualties. Troops would be killed, most likely. There would be the same problems and the same challenges of governing territory or holding territory in a foreign country, which they experienced during the Iraq War. So these are things that the American people don't necessarily want to grapple with. Right now we have a strategy of drone strikes and airstrikes, which, you know, and they do inflict severe civilian casualties, but they don't have much effect on people living at home or people even in the military to a large degree. So if we're going to actually fight this group, then we should do it. And if not, then no, don't do it.
Then don't, I mean, basically stand on the, I don't mean sidelines in a pejorative way, but essentially let the countries in the Middle East figure this out for themselves, Murtaza?
Right. From the standpoint of American interest, that would be very difficult to do, ultimately, because ISIS threatens Jordan, it threatens Saudi Arabia, it threatens Lebanon. It doesn't really threaten Israel, but it threatens many of Egypt, many of America's allies in the region, and that's unacceptable. And if there was ever a circumstance where one of the stability of one of these governments was threatened, that would be a serious problem, far greater than what exists today.
Barak, what do you think about what Murtaza was just saying? Either do it or don't do it, militarily.
I don't think that the don't do it is a real possibility. Beyond the fact that American strategic interests are under threat, and it's not just because of the threat to U.S. Allies, the U.S. also has a responsibility if it sees itself as a leader of the system, and that if it wants to preserve international order. So the U.S. has to do a lot more. And I think that the strategy that the U.S. adopted, to the extent that you can even call it a strategy, it was just too slow. We let that threat become much bigger to the point that they can now attack in different Western countries and cause that kind of havoc. So we were too slow. And I'm afraid that the strategy that will still count on local actors to take action is threatening those actions. I look at the Kurds. We are forcing them or making them stretch their forces to an extent that they won't be able to defend their territory, and they have serious financial problems. That's not going to be the solution. We need to do a lot more than that. And I'm really puzzled what the U.S. will do. Let's assume that the French decide to send ground forces. Can the U.S. avoid sending ground forces if its European allies decide that they're going to do that? I doubt it.
Well, how, I mean, picking up on that, how would President Obama, if that were something he supported, how would he sell that to the American people who look at what we did in Iraq and say perhaps we're in some part responsible for ISIS?
I think it's going to be very hard for him to sell based on what he did before. Though I think the American public will actually understand that what's going on in the region is too important to be left without U.S. Involvement. I'm sure that the attacks in Paris will increase the people among the American people believe that or those people that believe that the U.S. should do more, including send ground troops. He will still have to face the fact that his strategy so far failed. But I think that there is no other way.
That is Barak Mendelson, associate professor at Haverford College, also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Murtaza Hussain is a journalist, a political commentator at The Intercept. He's joining us by telephone, and Barak Mendelson with us here in our Philadelphia studio, talking about the terror attacks in Paris on Friday night. I'm sure you're well aware of what happened there and the questions it raises about what kind of response from the West to deal with the threat of ISIS. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email. See a lot of emails here. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Murtaza, what we hear from the people who are living under the kind of reign of terror, people living in the territories that are controlled by ISIS, we hear about beheadings, a culture of rape, just sort of horrifying existence for those people that have to live under this iron rule of ISIS. Is there a chance that they and others under this rule can rise up against ISIS in a way and overthrow or somehow discredit this group of people?
Well, during the Iraq War, the predecessor organization to ISIS, which was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the reason that ultimately fell from power at that time was because exactly what you're describing happened. The local people rose up against them in these awakening councils, which threw them out of their territories. Unfortunately, the one major difference at that time was the U.S. military was present to a large degree in the country, and they were able to support these councils and work with them and arm them and pay them, and it made that policy successful. Unfortunately, there is no analogous presence in the country today or in the territories ISIS governs. And it's questionable whether, even if there were, it would be able to be accomplished with such ease, or not ease, but the way it was during the Iraq War. Because ISIS has grown in stature and power considerably since that time. So I don't think it's something we can bank on, especially the way the situation is currently set up.
But do you think, Murtaza, that Arab countries can and should play a larger role in addressing the threat of ISIS within their own borders or within that region of the world?
They have to play the leading role at the end of the day, because at ISIS, it's a threat to the United States and its allies, but it's an existential threat to the countries in the Arab world. And I think most of them recognize this. They need to be at the forefront of stopping the group, because ultimately their rule is threatened by it far more so than it is to the United States or any country in Europe.
Bart, do you think that there are grievances that Muslims have in France or in Europe that perhaps they don't have in this country? And certainly when you look at some of the laws and the way that immigrants are treated in some of these countries, it does raise questions about whether they feel fully a part of countries like France, for instance.
Well, it is true that...
Hold on, Murtaza. Go ahead, Barak, and then we'll get you in, Murtaza. Yeah.
It is true that... Muslims integrated to American society better than Muslim in Europe did. But we need to remember that overall the number of people that join ISIS cause is so small that to put that on the question of whether people manage to, or whether the Muslim community manage to fit into European states or the U.S. Is probably putting too much on the community, and it's not a healthy thing. True, there are lots of people that have grievances, but I'm sure that some of those people have grievances even though their conditions are pretty comfortable. So there are lots of reasons why somebody might join this kind of group, but it's not just about whether they have grievances about how their community integrated into the larger society.
What do you think, Murtaza?
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think that it's productive to view ISIS, the phenomenon of ISIS, as a response to grievances in society, and there are grievances that people have. Particularly in Europe, which are legitimate, but the vast majority of people do not express them in this way, which is wholly unacceptable and is counterproductive and in many ways completely tangential from the grievances they have. I think that it's more, it makes more sense to view the rise of this phenomenon as, which, you know, is relatively minor, as Barak mentioned, but it's an ideological phenomenon, and it's also directly related to the implosion of states in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere in the Middle East. And inevitably, the amount of chaos which is going on in those states, some sparks of that will hit Europe and will hit even perhaps the United States, because these countries have diasporas, and when you have highly developed countries with relatively large populations which completely devolve into chaos, there are going to be externalities for other countries around the world.
About a minute before our second break here, Barak, we were talking about this before we went on the air, the idea of being a suicide killer. What is the suicide? What is the appeal of suicide?
I think it's easier for me to understand people committing suicide for a cause than to understand the killing of innocents, especially when you have these people that maybe truly believing that they're going to get those rewards in the afterlife. So if you have a strong belief and you're convinced that your cause is just, then making such a sacrifice for the cause, and again, even getting rewards in the afterlife, is not unreasonable.
It's also interesting that the leadership of this group, they're not committing suicide. They send young men to commit suicide, in certain cases, young women.
That's true, but many of them still die because they get hit by drone strikes. So it's not that they are out of harm's way.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. It looks like a lot of people want to join the conversation. And we are talking, as many people today are talking about, the terror attacks in Paris on Friday night. Barak Mendelson, associate professor at Haverford College, also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And he has a new book coming out next week. It's called The Al-Qaeda Franchise. Also with us is Murtaza Hussain. He's a journalist, political commentator for The Intercept. And his work focuses on human rights, foreign policy, and cultural affairs. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. I'm talking with Murtaza Hussain, Barak Mendelson, about the terror attacks in Paris on Friday night. There's something you wanted to say, Barak, before we get to some of our callers, and I got a lot of email comments I want to read as well.
Yes, well, I hear a lot about the idea of renewing the Sahwa, the Sunni groups that helped the U.S. In fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq between the years 2006 to 2008, 2009.
The surge, as we call it.
What we called it, the surge. And I think that it's very problematic or maybe even naive, because why would the Sunnis in Iraq cooperate with that kind of initiative, especially now that they saw the aftermath of the last time? Last time the U.S. made promises, but eventually the U.S. left. The Shia regime in Baghdad completely abandoned all the promises, and we cannot make any credible commitment that, first of all, that we can actually support them seriously on the ground in Iraq and in Syria, and then that we will be able to continue and safeguard them later on. So maybe the solution is to try to think about how to give them stakes in the solution, and that might require thinking outside the box, maybe in a way of either a Sunni autonomy in Iraq and Syria, maybe even a Sunni state that will cross the border between Iraq and Syria, but they need to get something, because otherwise, why would they take that risk when it's clearly the punishment for what they're going to do? The cost is going to be so high, because ISIS will kill anybody that will take that kind of action.
The idea of a Sunni state. Murtaza, what do you think of that?
Well, I don't know about the idea of unilaterally creating sectarian cantonments out of Iraq. I'm not sure how to generate the social, again, political cohesion in the country after what's happened over the last several years. I also don't think that the Sahwa councils are replicable absent another major invasion occupation of the country. But I don't also think that we should encourage the division of the country, which not many people within it are advocating at the moment.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Rick from Hokas in Delaware. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you, Marty, for taking the call.
Sure.
And a fascinating conversation. But
thanks.
One of the things I look at ISIS is they're living in the now. And we're looking back at a war that we got in. It wasn't very popular. And we never had Turkey with us before. Now they're in. And we could, logistically, having Turkey in, enormously changes things for outside powers to help, not lead. And I think having Turkey in the equation, of course, they have their agenda, too, with the Kurds. But I would just be interested in the comments from them about potentially using Turkey as a sure. northern staging ground, because logistically it's a game changer if we could use them and get in. And we've got to stop thinking in the past and think in the now, because ISIS is on the now.
Rick, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You want to weigh in on that, Barak?
Yes, I think that you're obviously right. The conditions are very different from how they were over a decade ago. And while we are scarred by the way that the Iraq war unfolded, they're clearly different. The circumstances now are very different. And yes, we're going to get much more cooperation from the Turks. We can imagine European forces. And we also, I understand the fear of American ground forces and then getting entangled in occupation. Hopefully this time we can plan ahead, and we can also imagine a situation where we do the heavy lifting in the conquest of a place like Raqqa, but then Arab forces step in the way that they're actually doing in parts of Yemen. So it's not clear that because things were done so poorly in Iraq 10 years ago, this option should be taken off the table.
And the idea of 10 years ago that we'd be greeted as liberators and it wouldn't
right.
cost us anything and that would kind of take care of
and so
itself.
We didn't need to plan for anything in the aftermath of the invasion. Hopefully we're smarter now.
Let me get another caller in, and Murtaza, I'll give you a chance to respond to Ben from Roxborough. Ben, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Again, to echo the last caller's Senator, a very fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
So I've been wondering something, and I'd be really interested to see what your guests get your guest thoughts on this. As we escalate, as French escalates in terms of response to what happened in Paris, I've often wondered, and this may be naive of me, but I've often wondered what would happen if more moderate folks in the Muslim communities actually organized, and I don't mean online, organized publicly in different cities around the world, had demonstrations where leaders got up and talked about, that this is truly a bastardization of Islam, that this is what Islam is. Not so much from an apologetic standpoint, but, mm-hmm. but simply sure. to send the message from the PR front that if young people are thinking about joining ISIS, if societies are closed-minded in terms of letting Muslims into their societies or accepting them even, or whatever the case may be, that what kind of pressure would that put on a group like ISIS if millions and millions and millions and millions of moderate Muslims organized in cities, and maybe did it even on the same day or around the same time. I'd be very interested in the
sure.
response to that.
Thanks, Ben, for calling into Radio Times. Murtaza, you want to take that?
Yeah. Ultimately, I think it would not be very successful or would not have a big impact on their calculus because they know that they're very unpopular, and there have been many demonstrations. More significantly, I think there have been Sunni Muslim religious authorities at the highest levels have issued very comprehensive public debunkings or refutations of ISIS's religious basis. They are profoundly unpopular in the Muslim world, including by, it's also determinable by polls, and they know it. The thing is, they see Muslims who condemn them or any Muslim who doesn't accept their caliphate as being equivalent as much an enemy as anyone else in the world. They see them outside the scope of their own conception of who isn't a Muslim. So any condemnation of them would just play into their narrative or just confirms their narrative that other Muslims have sold out or they are apostates or the murtad from Islam. So I think that these exercises in denunciation and rejection are necessary, and they should continue. They have been happening. But from the perspective of strategically harming the group, the effect would be negligible.
Even with the, we hear about using the internet, using social media to appeal to young people and using that as a form of recruiting. Even that, Murtaza, as a sort of PR campaign against those recruiting messages? You're saying even that could have a backlash or unintended consequences?
I don't think there will necessarily be a backlash or unintended consequences, but the people whom you're trying to reach with such messages, if they're amenable to ISIS's message in the first place, they won't. This won't sway them, or if they've already come under the sway of the group, it won't affect their calculus to hear criticism or recriminations, because they've already accounted for this. Their ideology has made the accounting that there are very few real Muslims in the world, which is why I roundly do agree with the description of them as a cult, because they don't see themselves as being of a great number or as being part of the body of the majority of Muslims. They view them as apostates from Islam, and anyone who condemns them or doesn't support their project is an apostate. So these criticisms, I'm happy to see them, because it's good to see moral outrage, and it sends the right message to people who do not know about the group or where it stands. But from the perspective of impacting their own operations or their own ability to function, and even to recruit the relatively small number of recruits that they do bring from around the world, I don't see it as having a material impact.
Let me get Jane from Haverford to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jane. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. I'm sitting in my car. I had to listen. This is so interesting and so helpful. My late husband was from Baghdad, Iraq, so I was a lot of times grilling him about things. But this is so helpful. What I'm suggesting is these people that you have for your guests, it would speak in some public venue. That would be so helpful. I'm sure many American people do not understand what's going on, and I don't either, what goes in the minds of these people. And sadly, once there's something about a Middle Eastern person or Muslim, everybody gets painted with one broad brush. It is so destructive. And many people are ignorant, I'm sorry to say, but they don't care to know or to find out. So I thank them for their contribution today. It's just most helpful. And I think the Middle Eastern people should speak out. These leaders of countries, speak up for themselves. Don't just sit there, and defend your people, your group, that everybody isn't a terrorist. Everybody isn't bad. That's all I have to say today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jane. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And I do think of this as a public venue and that we have thousands of people who are listening, but I certainly appreciate the comments. I mean, this is, I guess, it's not like we've had a version, Barack, of this conversation before, after 9/11, other terrorist attacks in the United States or even around the world. Is it a hard – I mean, it seems like it taps into certain fears that people have, I think legitimate, maybe overblown, but nonetheless, it does feel like we live in a bit of a scary world. I don't know if that's new or not.
It is a scary world, and now we know it better than in the past. So maybe that's the part that is new, and fear is very dangerous. Besides the fact that it's a very uncomfortable feeling, fear might lead us to – do things without thinking and to brush whole groups in one paint. And that's going to be very difficult. And we need to find ways to resist the temptation to just follow our fears.
Or to have a kind of knee-jerk response, I guess, about what to do.
Absolutely.
Actually, Murtaza, I wanted to read a tweet that you retweeted this morning, or perhaps it was even last night, from Ali Soufan. He said the IS playbook, Shia versus Sunni, Arab versus Persian, Kurds versus Turks, refugees versus locals, Muslims versus others, chaos throughout suspicion, hatred, and mistrust. Did you retweet that because you felt like that really described what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, I do. And it speaks to a point I made at the beginning of the show, that their goal is to polarize the world into two camps. They want to set factions against one another and be deliberately provocative in the goal of doing that. And as Ali Soufan mentioned, Shias and Sunnis were their first target to polarize and start a sectarian war, which they did succeed in starting by launching deliberately provocative attacks against civilian targets. which would invite government repression against the Sunni minority in Iraq. And again, they're doing the same thing in the Western countries now, too. And in their own statements, they say so. They want to invite retribution by Western governments and citizens against Muslim minorities, which will then force them to flee those countries and seek protection from ISIS, because they will be the only protectors left. This is very explicitly their goal, and as that tweet pointed out, in every conflict they've taken part, they've tried to exacerbate existing social fault lines for their own benefit.
An email from Paul, he says, even if we destroy ISIS in Iraq and Syria, what do we do about committed jihadis in Belgium, France, England, and here, he asks. What do you say to Paul, Barak?
Well, clearly the solution is not just Iraq and Syria. We need to strengthen internal security. What we saw over the weekend is that on Friday is that definitely the European states need to strengthen the cooperation between the security services, because what happened is something that shouldn't have, and they had to exchange information better.
So more information exchange?
Right, definitely. And we need to fight the fight in the West as well as in the Middle East. It's clearly not just one or the other.
I wonder too, Murtaza, with democracies that have openness and some degree of transparency, whether there are concerns that because of the threat of terrorism, we're willing to give up some of those freedoms. Is that something you think about?
Well, there's obviously some degree of tension between absolute freedom and absolute security. And I think that the way that groups like ISIS exploit that is to fudge the line between free speech and incitements to violence. I think that it's a very difficult terrain to navigate. And going forward, it'll be one of the real challenges in stopping ISIS attacks and detaining operatives self-directed so-called lone wolf operatives before they can strike, and not infringing on constitutionally protected freedom of speech. So I think it's something that will be a real challenge and will continue to be a challenge as long as this group is at odds with the United States.
Do you see it that way as well, Barak?
Absolutely. I understand that we need to strengthen security and that balance between freedom and security, or between rights and security. We definitely need to put greater emphasis than in the past on security. But I'm sure that there are ways to do it without providing the states just a blank card to do whatever they want without any kind of oversight. Lots of people will be willing to sacrifice some of their rights for the sake of security, but we still need to make sure that that it's not being abused.
On that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Barak Mendelson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's associate professor at Haverford College, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Murtaza Hussain, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a journalist and a political commentator for The Intercept. And we began our conversation with Delaware Senator Chris Coons. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can leave some comments on our homepage. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.